Each week we come as ones, as twos, as threes, as all of us, to create a harmony that brings us to a greater oneness, the oneness of our liberal faith tradition, the oneness of this church. And as a theologically inclusive church, it's our custom to draw on many religious and theological and philosophical traditions. Today in our religious education, our children will be learning about the Sikh tradition. I studied the looked at the pronunciation because all my life I thought it was Sikh, but I understand that the proper pronunciation is actually Sikh. And this morning's call to worship comes from that tradition. They are words of the great Sikh guru from the 17th century, Tek Bahadur. Why do you look in the forest in search of the divine? The divine is in all and abides with you. As fragrance dwells in a flower or reflection in a mirror, so the divine dwells in everything. Seek, therefore, in your heart. Each week we come together as seekers, connecting to the spirit in ourselves and that in each other. I invite you to find the chalice lighting words, we'll read them in unison, printed in your order of service. It is better to light a single candle than to curse the darkness. Today we each bring a spark of that flame that burns within us to light the single flame of this community of hope, love, and justice. Okay. And as the choir moves across, are you moving across?
Yes.
Okay. As the choir moves across, I want to tell you a little something about listening carefully to what they sing, especially our children and youth. I want you to try and really focus on the words that the choir will be singing. They're words from the Bible, from the Hebrew prophet Isaiah. And try and pick up what you can, because afterwards I'm going to have some questions for you on what that was about. So, choir, sing those words very articulately. I know you figured out where the story takes place anyway, because that word you had to catch. What was it? Mountain. This mountain is really a place that Isaiah is dreaming about, like a good time, a time when things are wonderful. And he talks about a lot of things that are going to be on that mountain. Hold that up, Mike. He talks about some animals on the mountain. What animals have we got there? Nobody knows what those are? What do we got?
A lion and a lamb.
A lion and a lamb. Yeah. Now, what do you know about lion and lamb? Are they usually good friends? What do you know? The lion will eat the lamb. But look at these two. What do you see here? They're getting along. Yeah. What Isaiah is saying is he's telling about a dream for the future when everyone gets along. He's also saying some other good things will happen in that time. Did anyone catch what some of the other good things? He talked about the rich. What are they going to do? They're going to share with the poor. Yeah. He talked about the sick. What's going to happen with the sick? They're going to be healed. That's right. In our religion, and in many religions, we teach that you should treat everyone like a friend. And you know, today you're going to study a religion that a lot of us don't know much about. It's a religion where you probably know that men wear turbans. It's called the Sikh religion. And you know, in that religion, they teach something very similar to what Isaiah was trying to teach. From one of the great Sikh teachers, we hear these words. I'm a stranger to no one, and no one is a stranger to me. Indeed, I am a friend to all. Isaiah tells us that when we all get along, when we're all friends, then the world will be that mountain, will be a beautiful place. He also says something else really interesting, and it's just one little line in there, but I'm wondering if anyone picked it up. Do you remember who he said is going to lead us to this place? Not the child, it's plural. The children. The children. So, you got a job, guys. Big job. Big job, big job. But an important job. So here's what I want to ask you to do. As you learn today about Sikhism, I also want you to think how you can help us to be friends to all, just like we had dreamed. As you heard earlier in the service, today in our religious education classes, our children are studying the Sikh religious tradition. We added this year to our curriculum in light of the terrible attack this summer by a cultural extremist upon members of that community gathered for worship in their temple in Wisconsin. From the reports that I read and heard, there was no connection between the members of that community and the perpetrator. He had no reason for his killing spree other than that of being a soldier in a cultural war. He viewed this community as a threat to what he claimed was American culture. He had an idea that the members of this community, whom he probably mistook for Muslim, were somehow religious terrorists out to destroy our country. Surely he did not know, or certainly would not believe, what we learned this morning, that at the core of this religious tradition, as well as at the core of Islam and most religions, is the Golden Rule. Perhaps nothing illustrates the religious and cultural wars going on in our world more than what is happening all over the Middle East at this very moment. Anti-U.S. protests are occurring in one Islam country, one Islam city, one Muslim city after another over a film made in the U.S. that degrades the Prophet Muhammad. Living in a society where the principle of free speech and the disdain for government censorship is bedrock, it's difficult for us to understand what's going on. The film may be the catalyst, but what I think is really erupting is a battle over whose worldview wins. Arab countries are demanding that the West make blasphemy a crime. It seems almost surreal to us, a throwback to long ago. And in a sense, it is, because the cultural war is essentially one between modernity and the past. It is also a war between religious fundamentalism and religious liberalism, between the West and the East. You know, we like to use the word extremists to describe them, but we are the extremists to them. Most of us in this room find it difficult to comprehend the position of those protesting. And you know, those on the other side of the cultural war feel the same way about us. We are deeply threatening to each other. On the world stage, things seem to be becoming more polarized and less tolerant, with greater frequency and vehemence in the attacks against the other. As the world gets smaller in this age of the internet, cultural clashes, often over religious values, seem unavoidable. But these cultural battles are not only being fought on the international stage and across vastly different cultures. A cultural war is occurring right here at home in our country. This year we see it particularly in the discourse leading up to the election. Did you watch the two conventions? Yes, there was a lot of talk about the economy, but not without a good dose of divisive social issues upon which there is a real diversity of religious teachings. One group appealing to those that want what they call traditional family values as part of the agenda, and the other trumpeting equal rights for women, for pro-choice platform, and for what really, for the first time in any political convention, marriage equality for gays and lesbians. In the book, The Cultural Creatives, about how 50 million people are changing the world, authors Paul Ray and Shirley Anderson write, two powerful subcultures are contending in the arena, the modernists and the traditionalists, and the fight is a struggle to define America. Viewed up close, this so-called fight of the century could appear to be just another political battle or a series of individual wrangles over single issues, abortion, school vouchers, multiculturalism, school prayer, child care, affirmative action, quotas, funding for the arts, gay rights, the status of women, the meaning of pro-family, and sex, drugs, and graft in the lives of various politicians. If we view the culture war from too close a perspective, we'll be missing the big picture, because a culture war is not about individual issues. It's not about politics. The fight is basically about who will define our social reality, and whose values will be the official values of our culture. It is a no-hold-barred match over who has the moral authority to decide how Americans live, both in public and in private. So yes, there's a great deal at stake, and the sides are very entrenched. It seems to me that hymn we just sang needs to be our prayer. Cure our warring madness, grant us wisdom, grant us courage for the facing of this hour, for the living of these days. And what is the wisdom that we can bring to both the domestic and global cultural wars? Certainly, we as Unitarian Universalists, modernists from the very beginning of our movement, need to stand up and be counted and make sure our religious values are heard in the struggle to define America. It has been our role in history to carry the modernist religious banner, leading the way of new thought in religion, and we should not abandon that role. I believe that we have a saving message for our time, and I know it is a good message for the world. And it's a big but. we cannot expect that those who come from a completely different cultural heritage will see the wisdom in our ways. There are very important values that we stand for, not just within our culture at home, but also as Americans in the world culture, and we need to be true to them. But I don't believe that fighting a cultural war is actually going to win many converts. How we interact with those who hold different views is just as important as bringing our values to the public debate. In fact, the way we interact may do more to allow others to come to our values, to see the merit in our values, than doing battle ever will. Let's return to the present crisis in the Muslim world. Yesterday, in one of the protests, there was a sign being carried that read, "Damn your free speech, this is our beloved prophet." It's clear from these words that educating the Muslim world about our right to free speech is not going to do much. And focusing the discussion on defending that right appears to many Muslims as an affirmation of the content of this movie that attacks Islam, or at the very least, a real disregard for the importance of their tradition to them. Yes, we have the right of free speech, and it is unquestionably the law of our great country. But how we use our free speech is what will determine how we are perceived by other cultures and other nations. In the first chapter of Corinthians, the first book of Corinthians, chapter 10, in a passage which, interestingly, is specifically talking about cultural accommodation, Paul says to the Christian community in Corinth, think beyond just what's lawful in your tradition. He writes, "These things are lawful or right, but not all lawful things are helpful. Not all lawful things build up." Certainly, this distasteful exercise of free speech is, in fact, lawful, but not helpful to our relationship to the Muslim community, not something that will serve to build up that relationship. To the contrary, it serves to break down the relationship. I do not believe we should have blasphemy laws, but I understand why many Muslim countries have asked us now to pass them. They're telling us that the way our free speech is being exercised is not helpful. It's not building up relationships with them. No, we won't give up our precious right, and shouldn't. But I do believe we should do things that promote speech and action that will be helpful, that will serve to build up rather than break down relationships. Now let's come home to the religious wars in our own country. The religious right passionately claims their view is the only acceptable view for this country. They have, incorrectly I might add, painted American history as one of religious conservatism. They view the faith traditions of non-Christians as destructive rather than enriching in the fabric of society. And they see liberal religion and secularism as a threat to the very existence of their faith tradition and of this nation. They want to go back to what they call the good old days, which I suggest to you were not so good at all. They were racist and sexist and homophobic, just to name a few problems. But in fairness, they were also less materialistic, less consumer-oriented, less focused on money as the driving force for all things, and they were indeed stronger family units. So what I'm suggesting to you is that in the traditionalist-modernist debate, not everything the other side has to say is wrong. What's sad is that in this debate, both sides give little attention to the many things that unite them across religious lines, and all place their focus on the divisive fringe issues that divide us. Many Catholics, born-again Christians, Muslims, and yes, Jews, liberal Christians, humanists, Unitarian Universalists, lose sight of the bigger picture, the major teachings of their tradition, and they dwell on the small beliefs or doctrines. Earlier this morning, as you heard, I quoted from the Sikh tradition's verse of the Golden Rule. Every major religious tradition, most schools of philosophy, teach that fundamental principle. Most all teach love your neighbor, not vitriol because of difference. We have far more in common with other religions and cultures than we have things that divide us. Moreover, I want to suggest to you that within these different traditions, there are teachings that preach against this cultural war and promote tolerance and understanding of others. We need to emphasize those things. We need to increase our knowledge and respect for other religious traditions and make room for difference. This is, of course, at the heart of the teachings of our own faith tradition. In this tradition, we acknowledge that all the great religions and schools of thought have truth to teach us, and we proclaim the equal worth and dignity of every person. From our Unitarian tradition, we understand that our world is one world and that we are one with every person. There is no us versus them because there is only us, all of us. And from our Universalist side, we learn that the great love, the love of the God, as they call it, excludes no one. These are the principles with which we should arm ourselves as we engage in this cultural war. But when our focus is drawn to these other traditions, it is almost always to the things with which we disagree. I, the other day, was shocked and angered by recent statements made by some in what I see as an increasingly conservative Catholic church in this country, suggesting that Catholic parents should not let their daughters join the Girl Scouts because this organization has chose to speak honestly about sexuality and family planning and be inclusive and affirming of lesbian girls and leaders. It seemed outrageous to me. But then I thought about the Boy Scouts. I'm an Eagle Scout, and as a gay man, essentially disowned by them. I had many wonderful experiences as a scout, but also I know the harm that this lack of inclusion did to me and is doing to young gay boys all the time right now. Several times over the years here at church, I've been in the position of being asked to participate in an Eagle Scout Court of Honor. And the first thing that comes to mind for me when asked is the really destructive thing this organization has done and is doing to young gay men. Yet, I'm so torn because I also know the real good things, the many good values this organization fosters, and the healthy things they teach. You know, many Eagle Scouts like me have mailed their Eagle Scout Award back in protest. And on a couple of occasions, I seriously considered doing the same. But I still have mine, because something held me back. Because I felt like in doing so, I would be rejecting it all as bad, and that was not the case. I have not spoken at an Eagle Scout Court of Honor, because I don't want to lend my support as a minister in this community to an organization that discriminates against gay boys and men. But I have personally met with many of those young men who are in the process of becoming Eagle Scouts, and I've worked with some of them on merit badges and religious awards, and I have affirmed their accomplishment, and it is quite an accomplishment. And we've also discussed the issue of the exclusion of gay boys of men. And I've told them my story, a story of being caught in a war, very much feeling a part of something and very much feeling excluded at the same time. And every time those conversations have happened, they've been profound. One of those scouts included a reflection upon this in the material that he took to his board of review. And some have even mentioned the issue in their Court of Honor ceremony. If I were a parent who had a child who wanted to be a Boy Scout, it would be very difficult for me to allow my child to be involved in the program, a program that would devalue his parents and family. But I would wrestle with the fact that I was denying my child a program that in so many ways also teaches values and skills that are good and important. My point is that even though I will not in my official position support or participate in this organization because I believe they send a message that I and our church condone this practice, which is directly contrary to our first principle, the equal worth and dignity of every individual. But I will never tell someone that they should not have their child participate in this organization. All this is a long way to get to the point that religions have to stop taking an all-or-nothing approach to things. Those Catholic bishops or spokesmen need to do just what I had to do. Look at the good of the overall program, the Girl Scouts, and not judge it exclusively on what is one or two policies. Policies, in the case of the Girl Scouts, that I applaud and they find as onerous. As hard as it is, as much as it can anger and offend us, we have to reach across difference. I know that some of you have done this. I know that more than one pro-choice woman in this church has participated in an intentional discussion group with passionate right-to-life women. There was profound disagreement on one issue, but soon they found common ground, things they could agree on, and even developed a better understanding of where the other was coming from in the abortion debate. There is no denying the deep cultural, religiously based divide in the world and within our country. The question is how we respond, and the answer is complicated, and there's a lot at stake. Yes, we're called to engage in the debate of our time and bring our values to the public arena, but even more so, if we are to be true to the real essence of our tradition, we're called to build bridges between our divisions. If we reach out to those of different faiths, different values, different beliefs, if we can connect at a level of the deeper ethical beliefs and religious teachings that we share, if we can connect at the level of our oneness, our common humanity, even though we may detest the position the other takes on many issues, there's a chance for dialogue, a chance that they will reach out to. And maybe instead of constant war, we can engage with each other and work together on those things on which we do agree. And there are a lot of things that we could do together. We can actually do the things that all religions actually call us to do. Feed the hungry, cure the sick, love your neighbor, promote peace. You know, maybe the lion and the lamb one day could actually lie down together. In our politics, in our foreign policy, and in our daily lives, the only way forward is through building bridges of engagement. It is a much higher calling than fighting the war.